Hey there, what's going on? It's Dr. Mike T. Nelson here, and we've got another awesome podcast for you today. My guest is a physical therapy wizard, Stephen Horney, and what he's going to do is this was his idea, which I agreed to. He's going to interview me about my background and probably just getting to talk about stuff I haven't talked about a whole lot, from how I got into health and fitness, some stuff I had with some eye issues, some surgeries I had when I was 4, and just kind of sort of my journey of how I got to where I'm at now. And along the way, we throw in a bunch of physiology for you and some pretty good tips also, I think. Stuff that I wish I would have learned a long time ago. So you can check him out. He's at iHealth Sciences, IPT, Sports Physiotherapy and Movement Sciences. They're located at 600 Washington Street at Morton. This is in New York, New York. So if you're in that area, definitely check them out. I initially met him at a cadaver course we talk a little bit about here. Through Tom Myers. So we spent a week of dissecting fresh tissue, which was super fascinating, and I would highly recommend that. So this podcast is brought to you by the Flex Diet. If you want to learn 8 different interventions for nutrition and recovery that you can use for yourself, and especially if you're a trainer, you can apply these to your clients right away. Go to flexdiet.com, FLEXDIET.com, and if it's not open, you'll be able to get on the wait list there via the newsletter. That's where most of my information now goes out, but you'll be able to sign up there to the newsletter for free. Go to flexdiet.com, and here's Steve interviewing me.
So I am Steve Horney, head of Integrated Health Sciences, but more importantly to you, I am one of Mike T. Nelson's cadaver dissection buddies from about a year and a half ago.
Weird saying, but yes.
Yeah, it's a weird way to meet someone.
I didn't cut him up, so we don't have to worry about that.
Exactly. So we were really lucky to be in the same class, and I feel really lucky to be the one who got to grab lunch with Mike every day of the course. And during an interaction like that, you tend to get to know someone, their story, what they know, and it adds a bit of a robustness to it. And I've always been of the philosophy, nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And that is through the lens that I view Mike. Now, most of you as listeners maybe haven't been lucky enough to have that opportunity, but I want to take you a little bit through his story that he shared with me during that course, because I think that it adds an element, a spherical element, to the information that you're probably consuming when you truly understand the story of the human. So, Mike, we'll start with today. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Thank you so much for doing this. And this was your idea, which I thought was an excellent idea, and I'm all for it. I think part of it is like you said, on some levels, I'm like, I don't know if anybody really cares, but yet they probably do. Like, I think about what I consume in terms of information from other people, and it's like, oh yeah, I think that kind of stuff would be interesting because I'm interested in that in other people. It's just different when it's yourself. So having you actually ask the questions, I think is super, super useful.
Yeah, happy to help. I think it's the difference between listening to someone on a podcast and maybe taking a course with them. When you see them in the physical and then you have those interactions at the breaks, before the breaks, and you see the way they interact, it can add or detract. And for you, I think it only adds. So let's get straight down into your story, but we're just going to start at the beginning. On my podcast, I always ask people, what's your story? I intentionally leave it completely open-ended because I want you to tell your story, but I would like you to start with your story of what you were like as a baby. So let's start from there.
If we go all the way back, I guess it was a breech birth, pretty complicated. I actually was born with a torticollis. So basically your head gets plastered to the side of your shoulder, basically. And my no one really knows exactly what it is. Some theories are, you may know, but it's maybe a virus in the SCM or spasm or who knows. But my parents as a kid basically had to take my head and like basically self-adjust it like every day. And of course, I screamed bloody murder and I don't remember any of this. I don't remember anything that was going on. And the only reason I know that is because several years later in my late 20s, I got it again. I literally just woke up one morning and my head was like, my ear was just plastered to my shoulder. And I'm like, what the? You know, at first you think, oh, I just slept funny. It was something weird. But like, oh my God, like I can't move my head. And went to a chiropractor, a buddy of mine, and he kind of straightened me out and said, hey, here's what's probably going on. Have you ever had this in your life? I'm like, I don't know. Call my mom at night. I'm like, yeah, I had this weird torticollis thing. Have you ever had this? Like, oh yeah, when you were a kid, you had Rhinic and we had to do all this stuff to you. And
I was cool, like, you're also adopted. Oh. Just figured I'd let you know.
Yeah. And then I also had what's called an ASD, so atrial septal defect. So when you're born, you actually have two holes in your heart. Most people probably don't know this, but the heart has four chambers. You've got the oxygenated side and the deoxygenated side. So when you're in the womb, you're obviously not breathing air, but the heart is still beating. So they have the hole between the top chamber, the atrium, and a hole between the bottom chamber, the ventricle. It's called an ASD, atrial septal defect, VSD, ventricular septal defect. And so when you're in the womb, the heart's beating, but the blood's just flowing around in a circle because you're not breathing air. It doesn't really have to go to the lungs. So once you're born, those then immediately start to close up because now the baby has to breathe air. And in my case, they didn't close. The VSD actually even stayed open for quite a while, but eventually did close on its own. The ASD, atrial septal defect, didn't. So when I was 4 and a half, I basically had heart failure. So my heart at 4 and a half was the size of someone who was 18. And it's weird because I don't remember a whole lot from that time period, but I remember running up the hill in my backyard, just getting super winded. Like I was not active really at all. And then I remember a lot of the surgery. I remember going and meeting the surgeon. I remember it was actually a pediatric cardiologist, which is even more rare. So crazy guy, goes to medical school, goes to school to be a cardiologist, goes back to school, does more rotations to be a pediatric cardiologist. And this is in like 1978, you know. So it so happened that my mom was an RN. So she saw all these symptoms and she kept telling the doctors like, hey, something's wrong. Like something's like not right. Went to a bunch of physicians like, it's fine. Eventually got a referral to Children's Hospital, which was part of the University of Minnesota. Saw this guy, Dr. Katkov, and he's like, oh yeah, I bet you have an ASD. So they did imaging and like, yep. So you have a hole in the atrium. So he wanted to do surgery much sooner. Most of the other people wanted, the surgeons, everybody else wanted to wait. Because they said, well, we're looking at imaging. We're like, the holes, you know, doesn't look that big. Again, imaging in 1978, not nearly as good as what it is now. And he's like, no. He's like, you know, he has a lot of symptoms. You know, we need to do it earlier. Because at the time, now they do it when you're like super young. You know, but back then there was like three centers, I think, in the U.S. that did it on kids. And the older you were, the less surgical risk you were. But now you've got to kind of weight that with, you know, you have a risk of heart failure and everything else going wrong. So long story short, they did it sooner, which is good because when they got in there, the hole was actually much bigger than they thought. So back then to do it, they crack your chest. So you have what's called thoracotomy. So they take a bone saw, cut through your sternum, and then go through your rib cage, cut through the outside of the heart. And then they didn't have to use what's called an occlusion device. They went in there and they basically just stitched it shut, stitched everything back up. And then on x-ray, I still have the little, they literally look like bread twisty ties on the sternum, and use that to close your sternum back up. I was in the hospital for a total of 10 days. So you come out, you're on a ventilator, you're strapped down. Again, I don't remember any of this. I remember when I wasn't on the ventilator, I remember a guy coming in who was a male nurse, which was the only male who was a nurse at that time, at least in that area. And I remember him saying, okay, we're going to take your chest tubes out now. He's like, this may hurt a little bit like a bee sting. I'm like, oh, okay. He's like, and we're going to do it on three. And of course, he goes one, and then he rips them out on two. And I remember being so pissed because I'm like, you told me it was going to be three and you lied. And then that was like the biggest bee I've ever seen in my life because that hurt really, really bad. But you just remember weird
patchy stuff like that. Like, I remember them wheeling into surgery. I remember the anesthesiologist asking me, because they give you gas to put you out initially, you know, hey, what kind of flavor gas do you want? And I guess I said, I want root beer, you know.
Who
and
doesn't?
Then, playing with other kids around the area. And when I came out, I remember waking up being just completely strapped down because you've got, you know, so many tubes and everything going on. And I remember getting use of my right hand after a while. So they had everything only on my left hand. And I remember seeing dirt between my fingers, which I thought was weird, you know, just weird stuff like that.
Yeah, the way you remember things like that in flat. I had surgery when I was really young.
Yeah.
I can remember the nurse coming in. I had to get a shot in my butt. And I remember other nurses came in to watch it. And I still, like, I've thought about that moment so many times, and I still don't totally understand why there was an audience, but the world may never know. But yeah, the flashes.
Yeah. So the good part is, after that, I didn't really have any long-term effects. What's kind of funny, though, is there's so few cases at that point, they wanted to follow up case history on everybody. And so up until I was 40, I think. Was it 40 or 38? I had to go back to the pediatric cardiology office. So, you know, I'm like, you know, 25, 30, you know, waiting in the pediatric cardiologist's office,
like, what,
as a patient.
Or something like,
yeah,
how tall
6'3",
are you? For
yeah.
anyone who just knows for you from your voice, they don't know how tall you are.
Yeah,
like,
you're
a big dude.
Yeah, so I'm 6'3", and it's funny, like, oh, Mike Nelson, you're gonna wander back in there, you know. And it, every time I went in, they're like, okay, everything looks fine. And then he'd say, okay, come back in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it was once I was 40, he's like, you know, ah, you're good, we release you. But yeah, it was the same pediatric cardiologist I saw for many years up until. He unfortunately passed away, I think, like 7 years ago.
Yeah.
So,
you're kind of almost lucky, though, that it was big enough that they caught it, because
yeah.
you wouldn't be the first person who would have that, have AFib, have a clot,
yeah.
have a stroke, and die. So
totally.
It is nice that you were kind of bad enough to be in the good category that they caught that. So then how
yeah.
did that take you through to kind of grade school, then in elementary school, everything through there? What did that look like?
It's funny because, like, all this stuff, like, I never pieced together. Like, I remember having open heart surgery and all that kind of stuff, but I also had, when I was a kid, had some vision stuff. So I had what's called a lazy eye or strabismus, and in short, I had two eyes that didn't follow each other. So at the time, I remember my parents taking me in to the optometrist, and I guess I told them, they do this little study, they're like, okay, how many of these little dogs do you see at the other end? And I guess I told my parents, I'm like, well, I see two, but only one of them's real.
You figured it out
because
by then. Like,
if
yeah.
you see in double vision, when you interact with your environment, you learn what's a real image and what's a false image. So at the time, they said, oh, you've got, you know, what they call a lazy eye, your eyes don't track. Mm-hmm. So we'll patch, quote unquote, the good eye, and then, oh, your eyes track, and like, you're good. Oh, great. And then it was not until I did some training through Z-Health, probably in my mid-20s, where they're doing a bunch of visual tracking, they're doing some other visual courses, and everyone's like, oh my God, you got to test this guy's eyes. They're just crazy, like doing all sorts of crazy shit.
Thanks.
And so they start asking me about my history and stuff, and I'm like, oh. And then you, like on the open heart surgery, you think back on all this stuff too. You're like, scared the crap out of my parents trying to drive a car. Because depth mm-hmm. perception, like, it's completely yeah. different. So what happens with the brain is, if your brain has like two options, it can see in double vision, but that's really bad. That's not like the best thing. So it has a workaround where it says, okay, I'm going to do what's called a visual suppression of one eye.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we've got two eyes; they're offset a little bit. They each create this picture in the back of the brain. And because our eyes are offset, the picture is offset like just a little bit. And our brain takes those two images and it fuses them together, creates a 3D impression of the world around us. So in my case, the images are off so much that I can't fuse the images. So I started seeing double vision. I started seeing two of everything.
Mm.
So the brain's solution is to do what's called visual suppression, where it'll drop one of the images. So I can see fine out of my right eye, everything's great. I can see fine out of my left eye, everything's great. But when the images go to combine, they're too far apart. So the brain goes, oh, I don't want to see in double vision. I'll just drop this image from the right eye. Aha! No more double vision. Yay, we solved the problem. But you drop from binocular to monocular vision in order to accomplish that. but I didn't know any of this, right? It's like someone who's colorblind and can't see the color purple. It's like trying to explain to them like what purple looks like. They could probably show you purple, like, because they've learned, okay, this is purple, doesn't look like purple, but they don't know any different, right? So it's like, what is it like to not see in 3D? I'm like, I don't know. This is what I've done, like, other than a few flashes here and there, like, my whole life. So I had kind of that going on. And then you think back to having the heart surgery, and you think back, especially in your case, with just simple motor development stuff, right? Mm-hmm. All the different things kids go through, the more movement you have. It's like, oh, what did you do as a kid? I'm like, I was horrible at sports. I hated basketball, even though I kind of played it. I was just horrible at it. I liked reading. Why? Because monocular view, right? Pages don't move, and you don't have to move. Oh, this is great.
Win-win.
You get kind of, you know, rewarded for the things you do better at. So I was a better student because, you know, studying with all the things I could pick from was, for me, actually easier than, like, I hated ball sports. Like, if, oh, like the amount of angst I would have to, like, play ball sports in gym class is just unreal, right? Because they always did the thing where, like, they would, sometimes the gym teacher would assign you to teams, but most of the time was, like, you'd have to pick teams. And I was always, like, the last person picked. And then there would be an argument about, do we actually have to have him on our team, or can we just not play with him?
been there, man. It's things you remember from your childhood. Yeah. And it makes sense why kids avoid things that they're not good at and gravitate towards things they are.
Oh, totally.
Because that age, it's such a sensitive time. And then also, it's the real world in some ways. Like, you want a blunt, honest answer. You ask a 7-year-old. They're going to tell you exactly what it is. So that's not fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I just thought that, you know, growing up, like, some kids are just not athletic. Like, I just assumed I'm just not athletic, that, you know, some kids like me just get hit in the face with balls. That's just what happens to them. Yeah, I didn't realize until later that, oh yeah, if you can't track objects in space, yeah, that's probably going to happen, right? So a pop fly, I hated softball. One, trying to hit a moving object was hard. But like a pop fly, right, you look up, and to most people, they have plenty of time, right? Because the ball is coming straight down. To my brain, it's like, I know I have plenty of time, I don't know where it is. Like, I can see it. I know it's there, but I don't know what's going to happen next, because there's all the workarounds in the frame of references that you kind of learn from, you know, parallax and how the light hits it and movement and just anticipation and all this stuff. It's all kind of removed from that, right? Because you're just looking up at a blue sky and a ball. So that was, like, for most people, very easy, but for me, very, very hard. And then obviously you have the whole thing of, like, everyone else thinks it's easy and they can do it, so they don't know what the hell's wrong with you.
And you gravitate away.
Yeah, and you're like, this is horrible. I hate sports. Ah, I hate school.
Totally, totally fair. And you're not the first person to mention, though, that some people are better and worse, and there's a bit of a bell curve. But to be that bad, and it was first, I think, Greg Rose from FMS that I heard really kind of, like, summarize it, saying, like, it's not normal to be that bad of an athlete.
No.
And it's kind of nice. I think in years in my world, we would look at it, dissect it down, say, oh, like, you can't do reciprocal patterns. You can't do the vision. Like, you would scream for that. But you're back then, and we're not too dissimilar in age. It wasn't really you either do it or you couldn't. If you could do it, you were encouraged. If you couldn't do it, you did just enough to get by. And then you went and did things that made you feel good. There wasn't kind of challenge yourself mentality. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, same thing. I remember Dr. Cobb saying, is like, it's, if you're a younger kid, it's not normal to be unathletic.
Yep.
Right. There's something that either pathologically or a developmental issue, or there's something going on. Like, there's different levels of athletes. Yeah, not everyone's going to be an elite athlete, but to be really, really bad, that something's going on.
Yeah. Amen. And so then that carried you through. And I think this was one of the questions that gave me a gateway. To stereotype, was like, looked at you, I'm like, D end, tight end, totally must have played football. Like, there's no doubt in my mind this guy played D2 football, but like, they also tried to walk on for the basketball. Like, I had this whole image of you built in my mind of who it was. And I asked the simple question, like, so did you like what were you like at sports in high, actually I think exactly was what sports did you play in high school, like not even giving you room to not have the answer be, well, actually I read a lot and did. But talk me through high school just a little bit, then what did that look like?
Basically I hated high school. I didn't like sure. any aspect of it per se.
Athletics for sure, and then not to just view it, it's how I naturally go, but like tell me what your relationships were with athletics and then how you think that affected your social existence in high school.
So I played basketball since like fifth grade. I was pretty horrible at it. I didn't really like it, but it was kind of like, well, that's kind of the thing that you do, right? And again, I just thought, I'm just unathletic, I just need to practice more, I'll get better. I got better. I got to the point where, to a normal person who never played basketball, I was kind of passable.
That's all you need.
But yeah, that was about it. And then also started having a lot of knee pain, just from all the running and that kind of stuff. And didn't really lift any weights. Like, no one really showed us how to do any of that stuff. We had, and you're old enough to remember this too, the old presidential fitness test.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, which...
Your pull-ups, your hang, and your push-ups.
In theory, is a good idea, but horribly executed.
Oh, yes.
Right? So should we have some standards and all this kind of stuff? Yes, I agree. But it should be done as a way to show kids like how to train. Like, how do you get better at these things? And we just had it every year. And the only thing it was like the thing you had to do in front of everyone in front of the class. Mm-hmm. And all they did is just give you a grade on it. And I still remember doing the pull-ups for me were the worst, right? Because I was about 6'3" in about sixth grade.
Oh, right. So you had a bit, so that explains somewhat perhaps a quotient of that knee pain with that velocity of your growth, like steep as anything. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Makes
so,
sense.
Yeah, super steep. I mean, I graduated high school at 6'3", 156 pounds. Like,
me too.
Going into college. And I remember the gym teacher the one year, he's like, okay, get up on the bar. Yep. Okay. Hang from the bar. Okay. Got it. He's like, okay, you can start now. And I'm like, I am starting. He's like,
and I'm almost done.
You're not moving. You're like, you haven't moved an inch. I'm like, I can't move anyway. You know?
What are you not getting here, teach?
Yeah. And everyone's like, oh my God. Oh, you know, like you in 10th grade, we finally got to do a weight training class. Mm. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. They're actually going to show us like how to get better at some of this stuff. Cause even in basketball, like the training was just basically just horrible. Just go run, you know, man.
Yeah, sure.
And I remember them, it turned into like the same thing of like, oh, let's just test you and see where you're at. It's like, I get squashed by like the 45 pound bar. I'm like, oh, great. This is wonderful. I'm like, can someone show me how to get better at this? Nope. Then we go on to do something else, you know? So it's amazing. I even never wanted to do anything physical like after high school in general. I actually left a year early. My two best friends left to do post-secondary. So they went to college a year early. And I'm like, well, screw it. They're not going to be there. And everyone's like, oh, you're going to miss your senior year of high school. I'm like, thank God. Like, get me the hell out of here. And then the nice part was the state of Minnesota and the college paid for my first year of college then. So I'm like, hold on. I get 1 year of college basically paid for, and I get to get out of high school a year early, and I get to start college again a year early. I'm like, yes, I'm out of here. So I actually left a year early.
That's cool. So then what did you go into studying there?
Yeah, at that time, and I'll back up one other thing. The only good part was my junior year is I quit basketball because I'm like, this is stupid. I have just blinding knee pain, ankle pain. I don't like it. I hate it. And I decided, well, I always want to play golf. So I just took golf, which is basically just cheap lessons and a way for us to just go hack around and play golf. So I ended up playing with the people who were like two grades behind me who were good friends of mine. So we would go out and just whack golf balls after college. We weren't traveling for the team or anything like that. And so that was much better. That was like much more fun. That was actually probably the highlight of my high school experience, actually.
Okay. That's cool. Hey, that totally works. Do you still golf to this day at all? Or does that kind of live there in its purest state?
What's funny is that I didn't play until I did my master's at Michigan Tech University. So I'm in graduate school there, did some undergrad stuff there too. And there's not much going on up there in the UP of Michigan in Houghton. Beautiful place. Stayed up there summer to finish. And so my roommate played. I just came back, took my dad's old golf clubs from like the 1970s. And it was more or less just an excuse to go out on a Friday, like leave the lab early and just go outside and hit golf balls. And then only at Michigan Tech would you actually have an algorithm to calculate your score. So we started playing beer golf, which is five people, a sober driver, and then you have got two teams of two. And again, it's a school full of engineers, so of course there has to be an algorithm to calculate your score.
Naturally.
So what it is if you go out in the hole, let's say I get a five, my partner gets a seven. So you initially find your average, right? So 5 + 7 = 12 divided by two. So we're at six. Got it. Okay, now you have to add the difference. So 7 - 5 = 2, 6 + 2. Okay, my difference now, I'm up to 8. And then beer is a direct subtraction off of the hole. So how many beers you drank on that hole? So if I had one and my partner had two, right? So that's three beers. So I was at an 8. So an 8 - 3, I'm now at a 5.
Per hole?
Per hole.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And you're a smart dude. You can figure out where this goes pretty fast.
And I played rugby, too. Like that, but that is some gangster stuff.
Oh, it was. We never finished 9 holes. We got close once. We made it to 7 holes once. We had the sprinklers turned on us to get us to go away, which we thought was fun. So we started playing in the sprinklers, which the golf place didn't think was very fun. One other time, I couldn't find my partner because he was passed out laughing behind a pine tree. So all sorts of crazy stuff with beer golf. So after that, I played a little bit my first year out of college, and then I kind of reached the decision of like, do I really like this? Am I getting better? Do I really want to keep doing this? Or am I just creating a lot of really bad habits that if I ever want to take it seriously later, I'm going to have to unlearn?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm just creating a lot of really bad habits. So I actually just stopped. I figured, at some point I'll take it up again.
Yeah, but I think you won. As far as good golf stories and good memories, most people who take it too seriously have a smattering of positive, mostly negative emotions towards golf. It sounds like you just hit it right where you needed it to be in high school and then afterwards. And then you left it, dropped the mic, and you were done. That's quite smart, I would say.
And I mean, we used it, like my roommate and I, we would just play golf and just talk shit to each other the whole time. Right. So it'd be like, I bet you a beer at the bar, you're going to slice it into the woods again and kill some birds. He's like, no. He gets up there. Whoosh.
He's guaranteed.
Like, yeah, damn it. And one more beer for me. So yeah, made it entertaining.
That's awesome. So what was your major in undergrad then? So you went one year early from high school. Your undergrad and your undergrad grad school, we'll get to PhD and everything there, but like you left a year early and then your undergrad major was when you went in and when you came out. If they're the same, that's cool.
Yeah. So I was like, I wanted to do engineering stuff because I had a radio controlled car, like 10 scale one that I would tear apart and recreate it and made all sorts of stuff. But I always loved physiology and biology. So people are like, oh, you should go do biomedical engineering, which in the early 90s was a pretty new thing. But at the time, there really wasn't many colleges where biomedical engineering was like a real program. And then the handful of engineers I met at the time were, you know, pretty smart, but I felt like I could never have a conversation with them and I never knew anything that they said. And I'm like, but if you're in a company and you have to kind of communicate with other people, maybe you should have a little bit of a wider background.
Yeah.
You know, cause if you go into engineering school, it's like, you know, math, calculus, it's, you know, you don't take a lot of liberal arts, you know, stuff. So I went to a liberal arts college on purpose, St. Scholastica in Duluth, Minnesota. They had at the time what they call a dual degree program. So you do 3 years there, and then it was with Michigan Tech. You do 2 years there at Michigan Tech. So in 5 years, you would get a Bachelor of Arts in Natural Science and a Bachelor of Science in whatever engineering discipline you wanted. And I was like, well, that sounds better. That's the only one other extra year, and I get to do some other variety of stuff. So I did the 3 years at St. Scholastica, and I just luckily they had anatomy and physiology there, and anybody could take it. And there were one of, I think at the time, three or four colleges where undergrads actually got to use a cadaver lab. So for my undergrad, anatomy and physiology, I actually used the legitimate like cadaver lab where they got new cadavers like every quarter and everything.
Wow.
Yeah. Which was crazy because I'm like, oh my God, this is like so cool. And the guy who taught it, Dr. Cesaldo, was just really interesting guy. He's at this, you know, small private, you know, Catholic college. And we're like, he drives a Harley in every day, And in the summer, he's even having, he has like long sleeves on. Like, we never saw him like not in long sleeves or anything.
Oh,
and we're
tatted
like, I bet he's got huge amount of tattoos.
Yeah, total sleeves, no
yeah.
doubt.
And then, you know, this is back again, the early 90s, where now, like, you have tattoos, no one cares.
Yeah, of
you
course.
Know, it's almost like you're a weirdo if you don't have a tattoo.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so did that. And then I did 2 years at Michigan Tech. And when I was at Michigan Tech, I was like, oh, my God, like, there is no way I'm going to finish all my engineering classes in 2 years. It was just completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about going to graduate school. So they had a program there where if you did 80% of the, say, mechanical engineering classes, you could then apply to grad school if you had a previous undergrad degree. Okay. I was like, oh, cool. So I did my 2 years there, then retroactively got my Bachelor of Arts, mm-hmm. and then I applied to graduate school. Because at the time, they're like, oh, man, graduate school, you'll be able to get your master's in like a year and a half, no problem. I'm like, well, that's not much longer it's going to take me to get another bachelor's, so great. Of course, yeah. that turned into 2.5 years, and by the time you add all that up, you've been in college for 7.5 years in a row, and it's like, Christ, I could have got a freaking PhD by the time I did all this. So,
and then you decided still to go get your PhD.
Yeah, which is even more wacky, because at the end of it, my advisor is like, hey, you know, I know you've been here for a while. Your master's took a little longer. He's like, you should stay, just do a continuation of this project. You know, we can get you done in like another, you know, 2.5, maybe 3 years. You can get a PhD. I remember looking at him going, you're insane. Like, I'm so burnt out. I have no money. I'm loaned, like, maxed out to the hilt. I could barely get loans to finish. And when I talked to like HR departments, I said, hey, I'm kind of thinking maybe of doing a PhD. I said, do you hire, you know, PhDs in terms of engineering? And pretty much across the board, everybody's like, no. I said, well, why not? They're like, well, basically, unless you're in a very advanced research position and your research coincides with the little thing you spent your extra, you know, 2.5, 3, 4, 5, 7 years studying, we don't want to pay you the extra amount of money.
I was like,
oh, okay. Well, I guess that kind of makes sense. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. So you want me to stay for another 3 years, which will probably be 4, and I'm going to be further in debt. And I'm going to become less employable.
Yeah, less
when I'm done.
Employability.
No, I'm done. I'm out of here. Like, get me out.
Yeah.
So I left.
Totally. Okay. So then where did your story go from there? Because there is a gap between the last time you were in grad school and then your PhD.
Yeah.
And obviously a big shift too. I mean, at some point in time, and I'd like you to kind of highlight that maybe you were foreshadowing with the cadaver dissection, but where did this fascination with the body start?
I just always found biology interesting. So when I did my Bachelor of Arts, I got to take obviously some, you know, natural science courses, which is great. And then when I went to Michigan Tech, I always wanted to take exercise physiology. Like St. Scholastica had a really good exercise physiology department, but it was for graduate students only. And I'm like, well, can I just like take it? I'll pay you the money. They're like, no, you have to be in the physical therapy department. You have to be in the program. Can't do it. I'm like, okay, great. So I get to Michigan Tech, which is an engineering school, and they had hired in the Center for Biomedical Engineering. One of the professors they hired was actually in exercise physiology because they did have biology and some physiology programs there. So I remember going up to him going, hey, I'm so excited you're here. He's like, what's your major? So I'm doing mechanical engineering. He's like, oh. I said, but you're teaching a 400 level exercise phys course this fall. He's like, yeah. I'm like, can you sign me into the class? He's like, have you had any exercise physiology at all? I said, no. I said, I had anatomy and physiology. And, he's
and
like,
I was a pretty below average basketball player.
Right, yeah. And he's like, well, wait a minute. He's like, why do you want to do this? He's like, I can't sign you in for credit. I said, oh, I don't give a shit about credit. Like, I don't want any of the credit. He's like, wait a minute. So you don't want any of the credit for the class? I said, no, I could care less. I don't need any more credits. He's like, but you want to take a 400 level exercise? He's like, why?
Yeah.
I'm like, because it's cool. And he
say
looked
no
at
more.
Me and he goes, I can't legally do this, but if you happen to show up every Monday, Wednesday, yep. and Friday at 10:30, he's like, I'm not going to kick you out. I'm like,
yeah,
oh, perfect.
The class. That's
so
it.
I just walked
Free,
in.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. I'm glad that he encouraged you. Do you think that if he wasn't encouraging that you would be on a, I mean, a butterfly effect with anything, but
yeah.
do you think that you would be on a different trajectory in a different place talking to a different person right now?
Probably not, just because I always found it fascinating. And the good part was he actually stayed around. So when I was in graduate school, he taught some of the physiology classes. So I ended up taking an aerospace physiology class and a couple of other ones from him. Mm. By that point, he just said, oh, you're a grad student. Fuck it. I'll just sign you in. I'm like, okay, great. Because my research was through the Center for Biomedical Engineering. So he used that as a reason to say, oh, you're doing research in the Center for Biomedical Engineering. That's good enough. Because at the time, I ended up doing a master's in mechanical engineering. I did solid mechanics, advanced study of how shit breaks.
Okay. I wanted to do internal. Thank you for dumbing that down. Yeah. I did not know that, and now I do.
I wanted to do internal bone fixation, but I couldn't get research. So I ended up going to the Center for Biomedical Engineering. I said, hey, man, I'm basically going to get kicked out of grad school if I don't get a project. I can't find funding. They promised me funding for a year and a half. I don't have it. And the guy goes, hey, we have this new project on heat transfer in monkey heads. I'm like, great, whatever it is, I'm in. He's like, all right, you have funding. It's for a year and a half. And he looks at me, my advisor, and goes, hey, wait a minute. You said you were solid mechanics. Have you taken advanced heat transfer? And I'm like, no. He's like, have you taken thermodynamics too? I'm like, no. I barely passed thermal one, though. And he goes, okay. Here's a book on heat transfer. I enrolled you in conduction heat transfer in January. Here's the book. Study it yourself. You've got 2 weeks over Christmas break. Have fun. I'm like, oh, this is, well, okay, I got it. This can't be that hard. It was horrible. It was such a nightmare. It
sounds pretty hard from where I'm standing. That does not seem.
I tried. Like
that's no breeze course right there.
It was a disaster.
Yeah.
I got into conduction heat transfer. He didn't tell me that there's another math requirement for it. You have to do something called Bessel equations. And I didn't know this, but my advisor had just signed me in the class. He just overrode the requirement and didn't tell me. And so it's like, because in grad school, like you can't get below a 3.0, and even getting a 3.0 is like very frowned upon. Mm-hmm. So if you get any class that's in your core curriculum below a 3.0, they can technically, basically, you lose all your funding and you get kicked out. Mm-hmm. And I'm like midterm in there getting like barely a C. And so I ended up having to pay for the whole class. I had to drop it. And then I still had to know the material. So I still had to stay in there and study, but I couldn't risk getting a bad grade in the class and getting kicked out of graduate school. So long story short, I did pass all that. I did get the research done. We made a computer generated model of a monkey head with all the heat transfer properties in it. And then they put it in front of this big-ass microwave transmitter. And it shot microwaves at the monkey head. And we wanted to see, was there any, like, deep tissue heating in the monkey head? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, this is interesting. And I'm like, hey, who are these, like, three people from Brooks Air Force Base in Texas that, like, showed up on the funding thing? He's like, oh, you never saw this. Pay no attention to those people. And I'm like, okay, so get done. Submit it to the IEEE Journal. Gets published. Gets past peer review. All this stuff. And I get the peer review thing, and I'm all excited. I'm looking at it. And, like, here's these same three people are, like, co-authors on it. I'm like, who are these people? So fast forward 5 years. My advisor sends me a little clip from this paper that says, military declassifies ray gun. He goes, yeah, that was your project. I'm like,
that's what it felt like. Oh,
I'm like,
wow.
He's like, it was so classified, we couldn't tell you it was classified. I'm like,
wow.
I knew it was kind of shady. So what the military wanted was, it's called the active denial system. It's been out for several years now. And you point it at a group of people and it feels like your skin is being burnt by a light bulb. Because when you take a microwave and you go into what's called a millimeter wave exposure, or you go super high frequency, like gigahertz range, high power, the penetration depth is just barely a millimeter. So it lights up all the sympathetic nerve endings on your skin. But because there's no penetration, there's no... basically skin damage, right? There's no damage to the cells or anything like that. There's no necrosis or anything. But it hurts like hell. So it's used as a non-lethal crowd dispersion.
And has that been used a lot in recent times or since then? Or has it fallen out of fashion? Or do we just not hear about it?
Yes
or
and no.
You can't answer that?
So fast forward several years, I was at a presentation when I was doing my PhD for DARPA, right? So DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency of the military. So if people don't know, like, DARPA are basically the same people who invented the ARPANET, the internet, GPS, cell phones, tracking, all sorts of stuff that started off as just super high-end. military stuff kind of filtered out into the public. Mm-hmm. So they had this meeting. I applied. For some reason, they let me in and come talk about metabolic flexibility, which was crazy. Like, the very nondescript building in the middle of Virginia that took forever to find. And I've been, like, in rooms with, like, lots of really smart people and conferences and all sorts of stuff. I felt like the dumbest person in that room, like, by far. Like, these people were, like, in a room full of smart people, that is the smartest room I've ever been in my life, like, hands down. Like, no comparison. Anyway, so when I was there, I was talking to this guy. I was telling him about what I did my master's work on. He's like, oh, yeah, I used to be the operator of one of those. I was like, what? I'm like, they actually use it? He's like, yeah, it's in the military. It's called active denial system. I said, why isn't it used that much? And he looks at me and he goes, the military is not very good with non-lethal methods.
Okay. Yeah, at least he's honest with you there.
He's like, all warfare historically is based on, yes, we want to minimize casualties, but we're using basically lethal methods. And yes, there's some things where you want to kind of injure people and not kill them, but we're just not good with non-lethal methods. We just don't really know what to do with them. I was like, oh. And I said, well, how does it work? And he said, yeah, it hurts like hell. And I said, well, what do you do, like, if you pointed at a group of people? He's like, oh, they all get the hell out of the way. I said, well, what if you have, like, some crazy guy coming at you that's, like, in the beam? Like, what do you do then? He goes, oh, we shoot him.
Like, so, yeah, they have their levels.
He's like, yeah, they're clearly a threat then. Hands down, they're definitely a threat. You take them out.
that sounds like a very military answer, right? Okay, so you ended up crossing your paths with your past with that ray gun thing. That's pretty interesting.
And even another buddy of mine, I was telling him this story 2 years ago, and he's like, yeah, I had that tested on me. I'm like, really? I'm like, how did it feel? He's like, it hurts like hell.
So
he's
bad.
Like, but it's so concentrated. Like, if you're on the edge of the beam, he's like, you're in the beam. He's like, it literally feels like you're being lit up on fire. The second you're out of the beam, he's like, no problem.
Nothing. Oh, that's, I could see that being useful.
I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, after 9/11, like, all branches of the military, like, wanted one, and it's just kind of not really been used much then. And I think it's literally because it just sounds bad, right? Especially now, like, can you imagine the headlines of, you know, military uses ray gun on, you know, protesters, right? It's like, oh my God, like, people would lose their mind. You
2020
know?
So, in a nutshell, right there.
Yeah,
that's
one
thing.
So I think that's probably why it hasn't been used a whole lot.
Yeah,
too.
The optics probably aren't phenomenal.
Yeah, probably
that.
Really
okay,
bad.
So ray gun, then where do we go from ray gun?
I started working at a medical device company, which was great. So I worked for Guidant for many years, which is in Boston Scientific. Worked in pacemakers, so obviously little things that keep your heart beating. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I remember getting the interview. Guy goes through the whole history, and it's my last interview, and I'm like thinking, oh, this job would be great. And he goes, hey, what do you know about pacemakers? And I'm like, they cause your heart to beat above a certain rate. He's like, oh, very good. He's like, what else do you know? And I'm like, nothing. And in my head, I'm like thinking, they don't do anything else, right?
Yeah.
But luckily I got hired, and as it turns out, they do all sorts of stuff. They can, you know, keep little snapshots of rhythms, and they have all these complicated algorithms and all sorts of stuff. So that was fun. I worked there for a while. I worked in the leads division. So little wires they stuff down in the heart that have even little screws that'll come out and auger into the side tissue to hold them in, and just all sorts of really fascinating stuff. And then I was like, I've never gone back to school. I did almost 7 years. That's plenty. And that lasted like a year and a half until I found out, hey, you could take classes and, you know, time Guidant would pay for it. I was like, oh, cool. So I started going to the University of Minnesota, just started taking physiology classes for fun. Met a guy there who worked for Medtronic. And I said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about doing a master's in physiology. And he's like, well, why do you want to do another master's? I'm like, I don't know, because physiology is cool. He's like, well, what would you do with it? I'm like, I don't know. He's like, well, maybe you should look at getting into a PhD in biomedical engineering. And I'm like, oh. I'm like, it's, you know, obviously I have to do research, a little bit more work, but it's probably a lot more useful in terms of industry at that point. So I'm like, okay. So long story short, I applied. It took me 2.5 years to get in. They lost my application. They all sorts of things. I had to take the GRE, which my advisor there told me, He's like, we don't care about your GRE score. Just walk in and take it, which is the worst advice known to man. Like, at least look at an old version of the GRE and at least know what they're going to ask you.
Yep.
So I did really bad in the math section because I didn't finish 30% of it.
Yeah, quant, if you don't know what a quant is coming your way, that is not on the job. You're not just going to be like, oh, I got this.
Yeah, it was bad. And so, unfortunately, that went with my application. And eventually I got so mad, I said, okay, who is the person that has to decide this? They finally give me the guy's office. So I started just showing up and sitting outside his office. Like, literally, I would go down when he had office hours, which he was never there for. So this goes on for months. And the secretary, like, knows me by name now. So she would start calling me and telling me, like, when he was actually going to be in.
Oh, nice.
So I get there, and he's like, I don't know who you are. We don't have your application on file. And there's, like, papers galore. There's, like, you can barely see the guy's head through the stack of, like, papers and stuff.
Got it.
And I jokingly said, he's like, I don't know. We can't find your application. And I'm looking on his desk. There's this purple folder buried below like 8 books and like 4 inches of dust. And I sarcastically said, oh, is that it? And he opens the folder and he goes, son of a bitch, it is.
Oh, my God. Serendipity. Wow.
And he looks at it. And he goes, GRE, your score is barely okay. Wait a minute. You have the inverse score of everyone who's ever applied for engineering school. Like, your verbal and written are really good. Your math, is your math score a typo?
But have the other applicants made ray guns?
Yeah. Yeah. So he gave me a bunch of shit and he's like, we'll let you in on probation. We don't know if you can make it. I'm like, I've been taking classes here for 2.5 years. I literally have like a 4.0. I think I'll be okay. So I got in on probationary period. And this went through until I couldn't find any research. So the whole time, I'm like, I started training people. I started doing more stuff with training, exercise physiology. I'd go to exercise physiology conferences just for fun. And I kept thinking, I'm like, you know, maybe I should change my degree. But then, you know, the sunk cost fallacy thing, you get so far into something, you're just like, oh my God, I've invested like 4.5 years of my life in this. I just need to find funding. The labs are funded by a different company. I couldn't get the right advisors. And I remember sitting in a class on MRIs, was I had to take one electrical engineering credit. And the guy walks in and he goes, all right, we're now going to drive all the equations that are used in an MRI. And I went, oh, this is going to be bad. And he starts just drawing stuff on the board. And I'm sitting in here with PhDs in mathematics and electrical engineers who are in the PhD program. I'm the only biomed mechanical engineering person in the room, and they're all just like furiously writing stuff down. And I have like a minor in mathematics by this point, and I don't even know what they're doing. So I poke the guy next to me. I'm like, hey man, do you even know what's going on in here? Like, what is he writing? And he looks up at me and he goes, no. And just starts writing stuff down.
Nice, honest answer.
And I went, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm like, if I somehow miraculously pass this class, then I'll finish this degree. And after a couple days, I just said, no, I'm done. I just pulled the plug on it. That fall, went over to the exercise physiology department. I'm like, oh, this will be so much better. I know I have to start over. It's going to suck, but this is what I want to do. I'm done with math. I'm like, oh, no more math. Literally, day one, I walk in. My advisor's like, hey, we got 2 new projects, and they both involve math. One's on heart rate variability, and one's on metabolic flexibility. And there's like 5 people, they're grad students, and I'm sitting at the end of the table, and he points at me and goes, hey, you, new math boy, whatever your name is. He's like, these are your projects now. And I went, and I remember just thinking, what am I doing? What? I dropped out of a program to come here to avoid math, and now I get more math.
And your name's Math Boy. Cool.
Yeah, the guy doesn't even know my name, you know. Yeah, so that's how I ended up in the exercise physiology department, learning heart rate variability and metabolic flexibility.
Yeah, that's cool. And that's where, again, where you and I connected a little bit. I can't pretend like I knew very little, but was familiar with metabolic flexibility and HRV.
Yeah.
And I feel like when we were sitting in the back of the car being driven by, you know, by 2 of the best physical therapists in the country, like what a cool car that we
were in. Oh yeah, that was awesome.
Amazing. So lucky. But I remember kind of like perhaps taking the Cliff Notes versions of probably things that you had written and research that you had been involved in and kind of giving it back to you. And you kindly, not that I was wrong, but taking it and being like, hey, I'll take that alley-oop and then dunk it. And it was really nice because, I mean, so obviously both of those now have become very popular with good reason. But it's nice to know that you have that spherical knowledge. You have that understanding that goes well beneath what we're just seeing on the surface right now in people's podcasts and how they're applying it into wearables. Like I have the Aura Ring on right now and things like that. What do you think they're getting right when they talk about it? And maybe it's at the point where it hasn't been such a bad telephone game where it's getting bastardized at all. But take HRV and take metabolic flexibility and say, here's what most people are getting right. Here's where what most people are missing. And take both of those topics if you could.
Yeah. So I think HRV, they're getting right that it is a marker of your nervous system. It is a pretty good non-invasive marker of the autonomic nervous system. So the amount of parasympathetic and sympathetic. That's all pretty good. No one wants to discuss the math, which I get because... You can have hours discussions about all the different ways to do it. And at the end of the day, unless you're a researcher, it's not a lot of value added per se.
Okay.
Just do simple time domain, short, you're going to be fine. Where I think there's a big debate, especially still even in strength training, is people want HRV to be predictive of things. And in terms of endurance performance, it's okay. It's not the best thing, but it's not too bad. In terms of acute strength training performance, it's pretty horrible, right? But if you think about it, this kind of makes sense, right? So think of how often you've been acutely sleep deprived, especially with travel. You got a lot of shit going on, but yet you get somehow make it to the gym, you have a cup of coffee, you get through your session, and you either leave and you're like, that session was pretty good, or sometimes you actually hit a PR. Like your performance on that day is actually pretty good. So you can still perform under relatively high levels of acute fatigue, but you can't do that day in and day out. Right? We said, hey, Steve, we're going to replicate those exact same circumstances for the next 4 weeks. You're going to be destroyed. You're going to hate your life. Right? But acutely, you can kind of buffer some of that stuff. So HRV is saying, hey, you have this amount of fatigue, we'll use that, it's just sympathetic stress, on board, but you can still perform well. So people then go, oh, well, HRV is red today, it's bad, my gym is performance is going to suck, oh, I went to the gym, it was good, HRV is horrible, screw you. Yeah. Well, how many other things other than performance itself are predictive of that session? Maybe willingness to train, maybe vertical jump, maybe velocity. But a lot of those things are already performance-type metrics already, right? We can't even look at your blood. We can't do anything else that's very predictive. So to me, HRV, I still think my little, quote, golden rule of HRV is the only thing HRV tells you is, at that time, the status of your autonomic nervous system. Now, to me, that's, like, super useful. Like, if I can get up every day and know where my nervous system is at, I think that's a pretty useful piece of data. Now, is that going to predict my performance? Not really, right? So the analogy I also use is if I take my 2001 Jetta and a little V4 and I just jam down the gas pedal and I redline it to Cub Foods, I can get there faster, right? But I can't expect to do that every single day and have the car go like 200,000 miles, right? It's probably not going to happen, right? So you can definitely apply more stress to your system, and you can acutely do pretty well with that, but you're not going to do that day in and day out, right? So if HRV stress is kind of becoming more and more stressful, at some point the wheels are going to come off that, right? And you're going to have to pay the piper at some point.
And then where does your mind go with metabolic flexibility? Same thing, like we're getting this right in general. Here's what's missing.
It's gotten better. So I think in terms of health, metabolic flexibility is viewed as a marker of health now, which is good. That's arguments I've had with people for about a decade now. People are starting to figure out that, hey, dynamic systems, that's kind of the way the system operates, right? We need kind of this balance of this and that. It's not just this one single factor all the time. Where I think they missed the boat is there's still a lot of things of, oh, to increase metabolic flexibility, you just got a hardcore keto more. It's like, that's kind of right. Like, you are going to upregulate the use of fat as a system. Yes, that's true. Does that mean keto is the best way to do that? It's a way to do it. But you forgot about this carbohydrate end of the spectrum also, right? It's people want to just kind of put it into their argument because it's kind of starting to become sexy. Mm-hmm. And some keto people who were hardcore keto 5-7 years ago are now like, oh, all about metabolic flexibility, which is great. I'm like, yay. But then they're like, oh, but this is always what I meant. Like, you know, back when we were doing keto, you know, back in the day, we were really doing it to increase metabolic flexibility. It's like, no, you never mentioned that once.
No. Yeah, would have been nice if you did, but you didn't.
Yeah, which is fine. Like, if you're on board now, cool. Like, more power to you. Like, welcome aboard, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's, we're almost right to that point where people want to accept, like, your nervous system, parasympathetic, sympathetic, not just overall stress. And I know I even talk in terms of overall stress, too. So it's getting there, and we're trying to respect a little bit more complexity.
That's fair. So, okay, those were your two projects. You were handed both of them. Do most people do two projects? You can answer this very quickly. Or is it usually a one?
There's one project, and the fancy term is the look at fine-scale variability across different physiologic systems.
Ooh.
So what we were trying to do was look at, okay, heart rate variability, very, very small differences in heart rate. Ooh, what about the RER we get from a metabolic heart that tells us the percentage of fat and carbohydrates?
Oh.
If you watch it during steady state exercise, it kind of does this little bit of oscillation in some people and nothing in other people. So we were trying to use that as a marker for metabolic flexibility by doing a low intensity, non-invasive study, right? Just using a metabolic heart.
Interesting, which I know you still use very frequently today. You
have
your metabolic heart. I know. I guess times do change and times don't change. So you went through your PhD program and then you started on your, we'll say, the professional journey. But what did that end up looking like? Like right now today, my impression is obviously you speak, you teach. We know that you're a professor. You have private people that you work with, probably some who just want to age gracefully, some who want to work on athletic performance. Today, that's probably where you are. And fill me in if there's other things. From that day that you graduated, you finished up those projects to now, where did that wandering path take you?
Yeah, so as I was doing it, my thought was my PhD initially was going to take about 4 to 5 years. That kind of ballooned into 7, which was a complete debacle. Didn't get along with my advisor, all sorts of stuff no one wants to hear about. But in that process, right about 4 years, I thought I was going to finish. So I said, okay, I definitely want to be doing more health and fitness stuff in the future. Still working part-time for the medical device company. Was on call full-time for them. Literally was taking caffeine power naps in my car just to make it through the day and all sorts of stuff. I would never recommend anybody else ever. And by the end of it, I'm like, okay, as long as I just graduate, I'll figure everything out later. So I hired a business guy. That went on for about 3 years. So I'm still doing business at that point. I finished. I was still working at Boston Scientific at that point. They had been acquired. So during this time, I've been actually actively trying to get laid off from my medical device job because I'm like, hey, we get a severance. And I remember the day they got bought by Boston Scientific, they announced some layoffs. I think it was like 6 months after that.
Give me that package.
Yep.
Give me that sweet, sweet package to pay off my loans that I've been in school for 12 years.
And so what Guidon did is they had what's called a bitter pill policy. They said the normal severance, if you lay anyone off within a year, you have to double it. So I would have gotten twice the normal severance. I'd been there for 10 years already. Long story short, I showed up to work and my job had changed. So I was now working on an engineering team, but I was not laid off. I was so pissed. I remember telling the guy, I'm like, hey, wait a minute. Like, so my job here has been eliminated. Is that correct? Yes. But I'm still employed here. Can I get laid off? He's like, no, because you got transferred to a different team. I said, why did I get transferred to a different team? He's like, well, they requested you because you know physiology and you have a master's in engineering. I'm like, well, what if I don't want to go there? He's like, well, you can quit. I'm like, okay. Do I get a severance if I quit? No, you get nothing. I was like, shit.
And you'll like it. Oh,
so I did a good job, and so now I get rewarded by, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I stayed there for another 3 years, and
three more years there? Yeah. I thought that was going to be, and then the next day I walked in, and I said, you know what? You can take this.
Yeah.
But no, you chucked it out for about 1,000 more days. Way to go.
So I finished my PhD. I stayed there for another year. I told my managers that I said, hey, basically, I'm just waiting until you have more layoffs. And the rumor was, like, that November they were going to have some. So I go into my manager's, like, the manager of the department's office, and I said, hey, I said, I know you're going to have some layoffs, and here's what I decided. I know you can't pick people. I know you can't select anyone. But just so you know, if I'm not selected, I'm going to quit January 1st. And she looks at me, and I said, I've been thinking about quitting anyway. And I said, one, maybe I'll get a severance this way. Maybe I won't. Whatever. I can't do anything about it. Two, if I was in your position, I don't want to be the dickhole that comes in and now you're two people down. I come in after Christmas vacation and go, I quit too. So now you're three people down.
Yeah.
I would at least want to know some heads up about it so you can plan. I said, whatever you do, it's totally up to you. I can't control it, but just so you know.
This and is so, the facts. Yeah.
So luckily I did get a little bit of a severance. Not a lot, but I did get some.
You know, just something I think you had earned at least that, and I, hopefully as a moral victory, that went down. Yeah. Okay, so now that you're 3 year limbo, and now you're out the door, and what does it look like?
Yeah, so I had been doing my own business then at that point, right, for like 8 years, mm-hmm. and my thought process was, you know, if I'm not working 30 plus hours a week plus being on call, I have all this time to put into the business. So mm-hmm. just took more clients, did more of what I was doing. Started teaching online. So during that time, I worked for Globe University. So I taught there in person, taught there online. I'm just started kind of doing what I'm doing now, really.
Okay, so that was the start of that walk up the stairs to where you are now.
Yeah, and it's freaky. I mean, anyone who does, you know, even like yourself, like, man, I remember when the first time I hired a business guy, I was paying him, $2,500 a month and thinking, I'm not making $2,500 a month from the business, but I'm like, I don't know anything about business. Like, I know nothing. I didn't take a single business class.
Yeah, I almost actively want to know nothing about the business.
Yeah. So
that's not why I got into this.
So eventually I just saved up some money and said, I got 3 months saved where if I can pay that, and then after that, I got to start making some income from it. So, which was good. I mean, I worked with him for 3 years, 3.5 years, and it was expensive as hell, but it was super useful, right? So I learned a lot of stuff much, much faster than I probably ever could figure out on my own.
Too. Oh, sure. Yeah. If you trial and error your way through that, it would have been rough. Whether that guy ended up letting you in or not or into that course, we would still probably be
here. Yeah.
If that was the path you had to take, we probably wouldn't be talking right now.
Yeah. And everyone makes mistakes, right? So probably the biggest mistake I made is after I finished with him, I was in another high level mastermind, which was awesome. And at the time I was like, I'm kind of losing money, but it'll be okay. So I put everything into an ongoing educational product for CEUs. Had the product done. It was a continuation model. It was $100 a month. And I had everything all done. I did that for 4.5 months. I sold three. Not just three people. Like three copies.
Oh,
so after the end of that month, I was like $35,000 in debt. I was just like hating life. And I remember going to a mastermind I did with Ryan Lee, and I remember sitting there and he looked at me and he goes, what are you doing? And I talked to him a bunch before, and he's like, you need to do a certification. I'm like, no, I don't want to be one of those dickholes selling certifications. Like, anyone can do a certification.
I know.
And he looks at me and he goes, well, you're a qualified dickhole to actually do a certification, and that's what trainers pay for, so maybe you should do that. And I'm like, okay, why am I arguing with him about this? Like, maybe I should do that. So, so I ended up doing the certification then instead. So, yeah, so I didn't want to be one of those dickholes that's doing a certification. And then it was pointed out to me that, well, I probably have qualifications to actually be one of the dickholes doing certifications, and that trainers in general really only buy certifications. You know, some will buy CEU products, but that's probably a much better way of conveying information. So at that point, I decided to do the FlexDiet certification, and I had been thinking about that. I had most of the material I had been writing about it. I have done e-classes. I had tested it out with all my online clients and everything. It was just finding a way to put it in a system that actually made sense. So yeah, just did that then.
That's cool. And now you've talked about a lot of different information from HRV, metabolic flexibility, obviously diet, et cetera. And you've covered a lot of ground, and you've said a lot of things to a lot of people. Whether you have a direct answer for this, I think it's an important question to kind of ponder. Of all the things that you've said, because when I look back through my 14-year career, there were definitely things that I described in the past very differently from where I would.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way of saying, like, I was wrong about something in the past. Now I've adjusted my tone on it. What do you think of all the things that you probably spoke about will be the most likely to look back through hindsight will need some tweaking?
I think a lot of some of the concepts I may have gotten correct, but the delivery was horrible. Like, I remember, like, the first talk I ever gave to more than, like, five people. And I just thought everyone wants uber technical information. Yay! And it wasn't an academic audience, which I had done before. It was, you know, a lay fitness audience. And it was a disaster. It was horrible. And then I realized, oh, that's probably not the best idea. The first consulting call I ever did with Ryan Lee, who I've been to a couple of his seminars and stuff for business stuff, it literally happened to me the day that I put a literature review of metabolic flexibility on my old Blogger account. And so he goes there and looks and he goes, what the hell is this? No one's ever going to read any of this shit. And I'm like, yeah, for the audience I'm trying to speak to, he's 100% correct. Academics will, but that's not the audience I'm trying to talk to. And then I remember speaking at the fitness summit for the first year, changed everything, tried to put more stories and stuff in, and it went much better. And I remember when I went back the second year, the things that everybody remembered were like the stories. They even got like the concepts kind of wrong, which is on me, not them. But then I realized and went, oh my God, like this is how humans think. Like we think in parables and stories, and that has to be at some level like part of, I think, better presentations. So that kind of made me rethink like how I was presenting everything and even just what I was writing and who is my audience and all that kind of stuff.
I think that's pretty appropriate to what we're doing right now, that yeah, meeting people where they're at is a huge thing that can take some shifting. So then you recently on your podcast, which I really liked, you rapid firely went through all the injuries that you had, which I thought was really cool. And that's something that you and I connected on. Like we talked about your vision. Yeah. I was like, oh, what about Z Health? You're like, actually, I've done all the Z Health. There was something else. You're like, well, actually, I've done all the PRI classes. And then I asked you a question that I like to ask a lot of people is, what is not mainstream? Like almost like, what do you think I don't know about right now that I should know about? And you spoke about RPR.
Yeah.
Tell me as concisely or not as you would like, what your philosophy about Z Health and RPR and the way that you look at the nervous system, if you could sum that.
Yeah, I think there's some good systems that are looking at the nervous system. And my introduction was through Z Health. And again, I think they have some really good stuff. Again, like all systems, I think you probably don't need to go through 7 levels before you can apply any of it. So as I've done more stuff, and even PRI, I'm only taking 4 of their courses. Again, like you, I'm not a physical therapist like yourself. And that course, they're very much geared to physical therapists. That's who they teach. That's their primary audience. And so I remember doing the cervical revolution with Ron, sitting next to him the whole time as he's teaching, going, wow, he started as a dentist. And so now his view for decades is shaped around your mouth and cervical and, you know, all this different way. And he went back and created the other courses to speak to physical therapists because no one understands dentistry in terms of physical therapy because they're not taught that way. And I remember leaving going, I still don't know anything he really said. But when I get stuck, I'm going to ask people about occlusion in their mouth and find someone to refer them to.
Hey, and you that's worth the price of admission, maybe right there.
Yeah. So I think sometimes even if you don't understand necessarily what the system is teaching you, which again is not them, it's that's on me and my background, I've also grown to appreciate like what is the potential upside and what is the potential downside and how fast can you teach somebody that. And so what I love about RPR, Reflexive Performance Reset, which is based on the work of Be Activated Training from Doug Keel, which I originally heard about it through him and through Cal Dietz, is, you know, I've taught, God, I don't know how many certifications, level one, level two for them now, 8 times maybe. And it's crazy to me that you can poke on someone in a specific area and it appears to correspond to, I'll use in quotes, muscle activation of other muscles. Mm-hmm. And that sounds pretty wacky in and of itself. And there's days where I do hands-on work on people where I'm just like, did I just placebo the ever-living shit out of them into this? And then I'm like, maybe. But then when I try other techniques, how come I can't placebo them into the other tech? You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, if I really did and I'm trying to use the same words and I do something different, I didn't get the same result either. And then is that a subconscious thing? Do I really not want the subconscious thing? Did I not want the result? Because I'm being paid, I'm part of the system. So anyway, but what's fascinating is when you teach, you get to impart whatever your wisdom is to more people, but then you get more data, right? And it would always amaze me that I remember teaching at Onnit once. Young kid comes up after level one. We're hanging out in the lobby the next day before level two. He goes, hey, man, I did the little crazy ass drills you showed us yesterday. I was like, oh, cool. How did it go? He's like, it was crazy. So I had an athlete this morning who was a swimmer. We had her do them before her timed laps, and she cut like a second off her time or something. I don't remember the distance, but it was pretty significant. And I was like, wow, that's crazy. And you hear more and more of those stories where it's an actual performance thing. It's a timed event. And then even just teaching. I was in Australia teaching it. We had a guy there. Had a really hard time just doing a basic like sit-up, like abdominal activation stuff. Wasn't working at all. And in my head, I kind of think, okay, if we could get him to do a sit-up by the end of the weekend, that would be pretty cool, right? Yeah, you always kind of have these ideas. You're like, yeah, that would be cool. So we went through level one, wasn't able to do any of it. Did some stuff through level two. And on the end of the last day, he was able to do it. And he's like, yeah, I've been working on that for like about 30 years, you know? And so anyway, you see stuff like that and you're like, wow, that's, I don't know if it's a placebo. I don't know exactly what the effect is. But after you do something and you replicate it enough, you're like, there's something is there, right? Yeah. And I think there's a beauty in a system where maybe no one really understands all of it, but there's not much of a downside. It's relatively easy to teach. And within, you know, 1 or 2 days, you can do a lot of things that are pretty crazy. Now, again, we don't have the background such as someone like yourself. Who knows why it happens? I don't know. I can give you some long made up answers that's probably half bullshit, and I don't even know what part's bullshit, you know. But I think for the average person who is just a practitioner, which I don't mean in a derogatory sense, if they can go out and act as someone who can impart this to someone else and they can get better. And then when they get really stuck, you're like, okay, yeah, I don't know. Then we need to see you and we need to see other people. It's just like people are like, well, hey, are you mad at people like getting better with exercise and doing better nutrition? Isn't that taking away from your job? I'm like, what are you joking? Like, I wish everyone would do better with that. Cause I only, at some point it's like, I want to see the more advanced cases cause that's more interesting to me, you know? So I think dissemination of more basic knowledge is a good thing. And then looking for systems that are more simple, but effective is a good thing.
Yeah. And I think looking it through the lens of, we may not know the mechanism of action to the T, but we do have these things working well, correlating to these outcomes.
Yes.
And the other is just trying to figure out, well, for whom does it work best for? And correct. That's where I think a lot of systems, they get a little too broad and they get a little too full of themselves. We're saying like, this is the mechanism of action for sure. Whereas the way you put it, and like half of this might be bullshit, tends to keep people on the hook a little bit longer because you don't get that reactiveness where people are like, no, there's no way that that happens. And then they throw the baby out with the bathwater. So commend you. I'm going to finish you off with two questions. Yeah. One you kind of actually almost led me towards. But the first one is, I think you're really great at making connections, drawing from your different realms and obviously your vast history that we just covered. What's the next front look like? What are the connections that you've started to make between the different systems? And it can be anything between like gut and spirituality. Like I'm trying to pick things that are totally all over the place. But for you, you make connections well. What does the next frontier look like in your eyes from the connections that you've already made while you're in your molehole reading research and out at courses and working with people?
Yeah, so two things. One, I think a framework that I set up for myself is I allow myself to kind of mix fields at a certain point, right? Because the old fitness thing, and maybe it's not so much in physical therapy, is you have to stay in your lane, just do your stuff. And is that solid advice? Yeah, I'm not trying to be a physical therapist. I'm not trying to be an RD. I'm not trying to be things that I'm not, especially when you're new and you're just starting. However, you also have to realize you're dealing with a human organism, and you have to know that, okay, this is maybe outside of my realm, so I need to refer them to someone else, not tell them not to do it, right? So have a referral network, absolutely 100%. But if you're a trainer, for example, you can talk about exercise and you can talk about nutrition, right? You should probably have some training in those things. So you probably can mix those things at some point and be okay. So for myself, I said, okay, my level is when I feel like I have enough education in something, and then people will pay me only for that thing, right? So I'll test it via the marketplace. And then two, will organizations pay me to teach it? So for me internally, those are things that I use as just kind of a barrier to entry. Okay, at that point, I can probably start looking at other areas, right? So I taught biomechanics at St. Thomas for a while. I've taught exercise technique for quite a while when I was at Globe. Nutrition I do mostly through my own certification and some stuff through the Carrig Institute. I did stuff with mindset through the Mindset Performance Institute. And then I do teach once in a while for RPR, Reflexive Performance Reset. And I charge people just to only do hands-on work. So I think the bridging of all those, I think, goes back to how does your body arrange itself in terms of survival? And so the next thing I'm working on is what is like physiologic flexibility, right? So things that we absolutely have to have for survival, right? The main ones are going to be temperature regulation, right? Humans are homeotherms, pH regulation, and probably fuel regulation. Like if I had to name just three, I think those would be like the top three. And if you get better at those things, right, because you're probably going to have like for breathing, right? Whole arguments about breathing, that could be a whole podcast. That could be a whole year discussion. Sure. However, I would make the argument that because breathing is so essential, you will probably have more compensations in it because you have to find a way to breathe. You have to figure that shit out, right? So if something is really high in the survival list, you probably have more compensations. It doesn't mean you can't do it, but that means that there's another level where if you start peeling back those compensations, you can become more efficient and more robust as a human being. So that's what I'm looking at now. In terms of practicality, what does it look like, right? It looks like different breathing techniques, right? Hypercapnic, hypocapnic, hyperventilation, hypoventilation, stuff with temperature, hot, cold water immersion, sauna. So trying to put all these, right now I feel are very disparate techniques that are off kind of in their own camp and everyone's got some good information, but like how do they all kind of go together? Like what mechanism and principles do they apply under and then pull out the techniques from there? So that gives you a little bit more of a system to eval it, to see where that person is missing. And then once they have the basics, right, they're good at sleeping, they got nutrition, they got exercise down, I think those things are going to serve as the next level to make them a better person.
Yeah, and that's so interesting you took it there. And that I remember back to one of our first nerd outs where we were talking about diet, pH, breath, and CO2 thing. And I actually still look back on that conversation that we had as kind of like, I think we may have been on to something there. So that's interesting. Now, my last question, and take this any way you like, but why do you do what you do?
For me, it's fun. It's like, I feel like you're just, at the end of the day, I get paid to figure out problems. Like I get paid to be a problem solver, you know, which to me is probably because I'm too much of an engineer. It's like, that's fascinating. right? And like the Seth Godin quote is that, I think it was Seth Godin, that all the easy problems have kind of been done, right? We're left with the really hard problems, right? So we need people who are really good at the art that they produce, right? The work that they do to leverage and to solve hard problems, right? I mean, there's a lot of things we know about obesity movement, but yet I look around, at least in the US, there's a lot of people that don't move well and are very obese, right? So on one end, we could argue that, hey, we have all this data, but we kind of still have this problem of people move poorly and are obese, right? So for me, on an individual level, what is those problems that you get to solve? So in essence, I get rewarded for my own curiosity. And luckily, because of all the issues I've had, it's kind of pushed me into all these different directions to kind of experiment and play around with myself and then figure out how do they go together and then figure out, okay, when do you actually use that for what client? So one of the things I do now a fair amount is just Skype calls with people that are just stuck. They're like, hey, I got this thing, I can't seem to lose weight, or my performance is stuck here. Like, knowing all the things I know, like, what would I do anything with them, or would I send them to somebody else? And if I would send them, where do I send them? Right. So one person went through their whole history. It's like, oh yeah, you've been knocked out 6 times. Yeah. And all your hormones are screwy and you feel like your movement is off. Okay. You need to go see my buddy who does, you know, clinical neurology, functional neurology, like go to him in Chicago, like at least do a session assessment. If he says everything is cool, then okay, that's not it. We'll look at something else. Well, you know, that was a major issue and they had all sorts of brain stuff going on, you know? So just trying to figure out necessarily what is the next thing to do? And then kind of what is the next area that's like the old logs used to come down the river? Like, what is the kingpin that you have to pull out to get everything moving again?
Right on. That's cool. Well, thank you so much. Thank you. You are a beautiful, beautiful human being.
No, well, thank you for your time and giving up all your time just to ask me crazy questions. I appreciate it, man.
Oh, my pleasure. I enjoy it. It's nice to see someone who's so good at their craft. And again, for the last question I just asked you, but like, you're in it for the right reasons. And it's really nice to see someone who just genuinely wants to help other people out and who's really good at it and who's put in the work to become good at it, just to be good at it. And then it's nice when that's shared with the world. So thank you kindly. This has been an honor. I hope to see you in person shortly. Stay safe for sure.
Yeah. And if people want to find you and need your physical therapy services, how do they do that?
Yeah, for sure. So we're at iasinintegratedhealthsciences.com. You can go on there, check out, probably following us on Instagram's the best way is at iHealthSciences. There's a lot of overlap between the way that we look at the body. And I think everyone who's willing to change and look outside the box is all looking at the same things right now. And we're proud to be a member of that. And thank you for all your influence on that.
Cool. Thank you so much, man. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I greatly appreciate it. Big thanks to Steve for taking his time and interviewing me, especially as there was a tropical storm going on, and I guess it knocked out his internet for quite some time right after we did the podcast, or that the government or somebody was listening to us talk about ray guns a little bit too much. So again, you can check him out at ihealthsciences.com. Sports Physical Therapy and Movement Sciences at 600 Washington Street at Morton, New York, New York. Again, big thanks to him for all the questions. Hopefully this was useful to you listening and you got some more background, learn maybe things to do and maybe things not to do. But I think the big key that I've learned is if there's something you want to do, just keep moving forward. You only need to know enough to know what is the next action to take, and you can get pretty far doing that. So this podcast is brought to you by the Flex Diet Certification. Go to www.flexdiet.com. There you'll be able to get all the information. You'll be able to sign up to the wait list for the next time that it opens. And again, most of my information goes out to the newsletter there, which is free to sign up. So go to flexdiet.com, FlexDiet.com. Thank you so much once again for listening. Greatly appreciate it. Talk to you all soon.